Blog Talk Radio.
Hello?
You with me, brother? Welcome to Burn. All right, appears we're having technical difficulties. First show back in 2 weeks. My co-host is, there he is. Let's get him on this bitch. Ratwaraz, are you there with me, bro?
Yeah, it keeps cutting in and out, though, man.
All right. Well, are we all here now? We're all settled.
Yeah. Can you hear me now?
you sound beautiful.
Viral marketing.
It is the shit. Well, we want to welcome everybody back after our two-week hiatus. Welcome to the one guy in the chat room. And it's been a long time. You know, 2 weeks
A lot. A lot has changed, my friend.
So much shit has changed. You know, one of the things that has developed that, you know, neither Rabble Rouser and I were aware of was I'm actually a pretty shitty friend.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was aware of that.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. But,
so Rabble Rouser,
explain, G20. Why are you such a horrible friend?
Well, you know, it's a little thing. I mean, it's like, so, you know, I haven't seen him in a while, and moves back to my hometown of Portland, Oregon, and he's back in the city, and been really, really excited to see him, and I have not yet.
Maybe we should explain this deeper. So a friend of yours dropped everything, took a train cross-country for 3 days, right?
Right.
And is a mere 20-minute bus ride from where you are, yet you have yet all week to come out and say hello to him and his family.
Right.
Bad friend. Bad friend. I just hope that I never go to prison, because when I go to prison, I know that you're going to be that guy that wears the free Mike Franklin T-shirt one time and then never puts it on again. And
yeah,
never,
it'll be like, dude, it got smelly,
I don't know.
It'll be like the T-shirt I wear when I fucking clean the bathroom, and I'll be just like, dude, you know, the print started to come off after I washed it, you know, it wasn't white anymore. And by the
doesn't
way,
really match.
You know, it's a 20-minute bus ride from downtown. It's like 40 from my house.
Oh,
yeah.
Jesus Christ.
40 minutes.
Yeah, I know, man. Just think. Just think how many 40-minute increments were in 3 days on a train to get here.
Yeah, right. That's just one way, too, by the way. And, you know, I don't know about the rest of you, America, but I got shit to do. So,
In the time that I've been here, I've made friends with an egg farmer who was really awesome and much better looking than G20, by the way. Very good looking young egg farmer guy. And, you know, I told him that. I said, you know, you're pretty good looking for an egg farm. And he said, you know, it's usually gay guys that hit on me, so this is kind of nice.
No, that's fantastic. So is he a kindly egg farmer?
He
you know,
is.
We, like,
he
we,
is.
He's
very
good
kindly.
He's
the, yeah, oh, yeah, wonderfully, wonderfully. And he actually took time to come out to our house and hang out with us. So
that is great. He's like a new friend. He's like a really
yeah, he's
good
a friend.
Really
Huh.
A really good, new, caring friend who wants to see you really bad. And doesn't just say, but he does.
Oh, I made another new friend, by the way, too.
Oh, nice.
This friend is far more interesting, G20. so, of course, I use the Facebooks, everybody
the
else.
Facebook,
to use
the
Twatters these days. And get into town and post that I'm going to be performing at an open mic the night after I get into town at Muddy Waters Cafe. And who is to show up but this very out-of-place looking, but very somewhat convincingly dressed at the same time. You'll get my drift in a second. Gentleman who shows up and is using his camera phone to photograph my family and myself from a short distance and then phones in and uses the term, the location is. However, he's got a death metal T-shirt on, and he's got long hair, and he's giving the location of where we are. And so, a friend of mine who actually works in the field where he would be surrounded by federal agents at times. He's not a federal agent anyway whatsoever, but he works in a field where he knows what these guys how these guys act. Points this guy out to me, and he says, "Are you being tailed by federal agents? You've been visited by some friends." And I was like, well, we assumed that as such, but, you know, I'm not really worried about it. And he points this guy out. And so I, of course, first thing I do is walk up to this guy and I'm like, hey, buddy, so you here for the open mic tonight? And he's like, oh, yeah. Yeah, I've been looking for an open mic to play on Thursdays. And all of a sudden I see that this place has an open mic on Thursday. I'm like, oh, really? What do you play? Oh, you know, just play some music. And I was like, oh, that's cool. You play guitar? And he's like, yeah. I was like, you got one? And no, he didn't have one with him. But he was very excited about the open mic being there. So excited, in fact, that he hung out the entire time that we were there.
Nice. Did he get more pictures of the stage and the venue? Because I'm sure that's all. I mean,
yeah, he was just scouting. He was just scouting for an open mic.
Scouter. Oh, you know what? I'll bet you he's a record label scouter.
Oh, maybe they're hot on our tail. Maybe they're wanting to pick up some of our new anarchist music. You know, it's the new thing. It's the new thing.
Yeah. No one has ever said what we're saying ever in the history. So this is cutting edge shit. You know?
Right. So I just want to say to the federal agents that are listening right now, like, next time you send a dude, make sure that he doesn't look like a Gresham speed freak wearing death metal t-shirts on a brand new fucking BlackBerry, because
it's
just doesn't flow. And if you're going to send a douche to come by a fucking open mic, at least put a fucking guitar in his hand and teach him a Nirvana cover or something.
Yeah, seriously, teach him something. It's like the guy, you know, I remember being at this I think it was a Fish show back in the day, and, you know, we're walking to the show from the lot, and some dude with a fake dreadlocks wig and, you know, this really shitty hippie outfit comes up and goes, hey, bro, want to buy some pot? And my buddies, like, just started laughing and said, you've got to be kidding me. Really? Really? You guys get, like, tax money. That's, like, unending revenue. And this is what you got? You can't even get a little method about it? Dude, fucking Borat does a better undercover job than a fucking cop.
Seriously.
Wow. So they tailed you all the way to Oregon. They knew you were back in the town. They came.
Well, you know, and it's not like I'm not telling people where I am. I'm not hiding.
Yeah, right.
I don't think that if I, as an anarchist, if I were choosing to hide out, I would choose the city of Portland, Oregon, you know, to be inconspicuous. I mean, come on. But, you know, it's just pretty funny that that the feds come see me before my friends do.
Yeah, that's fucked up. That is fucked up.
I either need to get new friends or start hanging out with the feds, because at least they care enough to say hi.
Well, but here's what I'm saying, and I've kind of come around to this after this conversation, is really those in power do care about us, for real, enough to come see us play music. I mean, we always talk about how, you know, the president, he's not aware of any of us and our individual needs and wants and desires and ultimately doesn't give a shit. This proves us wrong. I am wrong at this moment. Not only do they care about you, but they care about your music.
Exactly.
I really am a shitty friend.
Yeah.
That's fucked up. Sure. That's fucked up. You know what? They should make a law prohibiting guys like me from even trying to have friends in the first place. I would vote for that law. I'm going to start voting. Just because
I'm going to write a really strongly worded letter.
Oh, Jesus Christ. So this is crazy. You know, this Texas military shooting is a trip to me, because, like, and you know, speaking only from a personal point of view, like, you know, whenever I see the high school shootings, whenever I see, you know, news like that, you know, I mean, I am actually, you know, I am disturbed and shocked by it,
Are you awed by it? Are you shocked and awed?
I'm shocked and awed enough to vote. I'm going to be on that trip tonight. I want to talk about things that are going to make me start voting, and I have a reason for wanting to talk about that later. But when I talk about this military shooting thing, you know, my wife and I are watching it on the news, and we're just kind of like, you know, yeah, that sucks for – it's sad for anyone to lose a son or a child or whatever, just in kind of the, you know, the abstract, lose a family member. But I found myself strangely undisturbed by the story, you know, strangely unshocked and unawed by this story. And
let's break this down. Maybe I can dissect why you're strangely undisturbed. The
please,
shooting,
please.
What did it, the person who did the shooting, were they a gun owner? And I want to make sure to make this clear that gun owners are not bad. I highly support gun owners, but I just want to get this out of the way. Are they a gun owner?
I mean, he was a soldier, so yeah, technically.
So he's a gun owner who was also trained to use his gun against other human beings by a powerful force, right?
Right.
So his job, in fact, was to shoot at human beings, mostly unarmed, innocent human beings.
Right.
Would I be too far in saying that?
No, you wouldn't be too far in saying that.
So he's a soldier who was trained to kill,
right,
and he
right,
killed people.
Right. So.
Okay, so it's kind of like the headlines that read, like, barber in Southside cuts hair.
Yeah, or dude takes laxative and shits.
Right, right. Yeah. Guess what? The bakery is full of bread.
Yeah, and in other news, thirsty man drinks water.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, come on, really? Like, we're supposed to be shocked when the trained killers start killing?
And, you know, I think it's one of those things where it's when the trained killers start killing each other that suddenly people are just, it really shakes a lot of people to their foundations. Enough, you know, of course, the media has been all over this, and you can never use that as any way to gauge actual public feeling. We've known that for a long time, that those are a bunch of fucking cartoons and cartoon characters telling us the news and information. But the way they've jumped on this
that's not dissing Beetle Bailey at all.
Who?
Beetle Bailey.
Who's Beetle Bailey? Oh, Beetle Bailey, old school from the yeah, dude, fuck yeah. What was the other one? There was Jughead. He was badass.
Yeah, and then what was the one that was the totally Deadhead cartoon?
I don't even remember, bro.
Oh, man! First call of the call, then tell us which cartoon was written by a Deadhead comic strip artist in the 1960s. You won't win anything. But you get to call in and talk on the show. Doomsbury, never mind, don't call.
No. That was over pretty quick. Okay, nobody in the chat room. Nobody calling.
We lost our listener.
We lost our listener.
Right, he's either a soldier.
You know, one of those. He's fucking pissed.
Do our best to piss them all off.
Hey, healthcare bill got passed by Congress.
Oh, great. I feel better already.
Everybody's right. I know, I feel healthier. And I was reading through it because, you know, Rabble Rouser and I were looking over we were talking about the summary earlier, trying to figure out some, you know, hot points to talk about. And one of my favorite ones is that this bill actually requires you to buy health insurance or else they'll tax you a little bit extra. It's not a tax. It's a fee that the state will charge you for not buying health insurance. So,
I wonder which lobbyists were involved with this bill.
I'm sure that, you know, and I'm sure that the health insurance cartel had literally nothing to do with that. How's that going to benefit them, people being forced
right.
to buy their product?
100% consumerism? I mean, that doesn't sound like a business model I would be a part of.
Yeah, they had nothing to do with it. And, you know, the American Medical Association, we can always trust them, another sponsor. They were able to get behind the bill, so I'm feeling even better.
Well, yeah,
and,
I mean, let's not trash too hard on the AMA. I mean, they were, by the way, promoting certain brands of cigarettes over others a mere 45 years ago.
Yeah. And they did help to get mutual aid hospitals shut down during the Great Depression, except
for...
Oh,
absolutely, because, I mean, poor people don't know how to help themselves. They don't know how
well,
to.
Well, yeah. And you know what? God bless them for letting the hospitals that serve minorities, God bless them for letting those ones stay around because, you know, people would have integrated, would have been weird. Hey, speaking of integration, I think I'm going to play a clip. Integration of cultures and people moving around. This is a news story, listeners, a very important hot-button news story about immigration. I hope you enjoy it. So here we go.
The following is brought to you by Doers, the proud sponsor of the Onion News Network since 1898.
America's immigration problem. This controversial issue is often reported with facts and information that are very difficult to relate to. Our Jean Ann Warden filed this report on the human cost of Mexicans.
Give up your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. These are the words enshrined at the base of the Statue of Liberty and in the hearts of every true American. But those words were written thousands of years ago. And as millions of new immigrants flood across our borders each year, the American worker is paying the price.
Until July of last year, Raymond Boyle was a senior vice president of business development at Lucent Technologies, headquartered in Dallas, Texas.
I never thought this would happen to me.
The man who took Ray Boyle's job is Alberto Fuentes, who illegally crossed the Arizona-Mexican border in the back of a melon truck 2 years ago.
Having a job gave me a sense of pride. Every week I brought home a check. I was able to feed the family.
And how much were you making?
$840,000 and a 0.5% share in the company.
An internal memo leaked to the Onion News Network revealed that Fuentes was willing to work for significantly less. Boyle was forced to sell his Texas estate and move his family into their summer home in the Hamptons.
Unless you've gone through it yourself, you can't imagine what it's like to live year-round in your summer home. I don't know what we're going to do.
I refuse to work, so it's been very hard for us. Fuentes, who speaks no English and has no formal business training, has spurred double-digit growth since last quarter. His supervisors say it's his ability to put in long hours without taking vacations.
I hope that Mexican man is happy with Daddy's job.
So Raymond Boyle and thousands of other Americans just like him face an uncertain future.
It's a difficult adjustment, no doubt about it. I'm working long hours, and the waitresses make a lot more because they get the tips, and I don't. It's really unfair. The whole system is really unfair.
For the Onion News Network, I'm Jean Ann Wharton.
Isn't that awesome?
They get the tips, and I don't.
And you know, the audio is actually it's a video, and where it says he was willing to work for substantially less, it was like $200,000 less a year. So he's the illegal immigrant. Was oh shit, that is good stuff. That is
so
good.
In true stories though, coming on the train ride across the north of this country. In Montana, we were at a train station stop, and the train station, okay, you can't smoke on the Amtrak train, so you have to take smoke breaks at train stations where there are specific stops for smokers.
Right.
They give you an extra 10 minutes to smoke. So we're pulling into what's supposed to be a smoking stop, and we stop 50 yards before the train station, and we wait, and we wait, and we wait, and we're there for about 30 minutes. And we're in the back of the train where people like us belong, and all of a sudden these like green-suited, you know, forest ranger-looking dudes who are U.S. immigration officers come to the back, and they walk in and say, "Excuse me, are you a U.S. citizen?" And I was like, "What?" I'm like, "Are you a U.S. citizen?" I'm like, "Oh God, yeah." And they keep asking, and they go back, and they go back, and. I see them taking a dude off the train, and Fair says to me, and the agent's not far away, Fair says, "Dad, what kind of cop was that?" And I said, "Well, sweetie, that's a border patrol cop." And she said, "Well, what's that?" And I was like, "Well, the border is this big imaginary line that they draw down the middle of the planet to separate one group of people from another, and then they pay these assholes and give them guns to make the imaginary line seem more real." And, you know, of course, she got it right away, but as we get outside, they're walking away with a guy who is from Mexico. And, you know, I'm sitting there thinking, like, well, number one, what the fuck are Border Patrol agents doing in Montana on an Amtrak train service? Number two, why are they taking this guy away? What does it really matter? I mean, he's obviously not a problem. You know, nobody was a problem on the train. And then it occurs to me that some worker on that train had to phone that in, that there was a Spanish-speaking rider that they didn't want on their train. And all of a sudden, this young man, who was seemed like a really nice young guy, was being led away by Border Patrol agents. It was like Gestapo tactics. You know, they come on the train, they ask to see your papers, and then they cart you away. It was it was quite disturbing.
You know,
even the Amish that we were talking to on the train were really disturbed by that. It's kind of hard to disturb the Amish.
Yeah, no shit, because they're pretty passive people. They don't really notice anything, you know, going on outside of woodworking, and that's pretty amazing. You know, it really blows my mind. You know, immigration is one of those things. Like, I am so just the thought, you know, just the concept alone of immigration laws and the prohibition of movement. It blows my fucking mind, and it blows my gaskets. I just get so fucking angry when I think about it because
it makes sense to these, you know, middle class white assholes who think that these people are actually like the immigrants are actually taking their jobs away. That makes sense to them somehow.
Well, it was interesting. I met a guy. I was at when the Motorhome Diaries came to Portland.
Oh, how was it? Did you get to meet up with them in person?
Yeah, yeah. They were actually got together at a whiskey bar, like up on right near my house, like a 5-minute bike right away from my house, which was really cool. And yeah, they were incredibly nice guys. They want to do our show again. They had a lot of fun, and they wanted to talk with you some more. And you know, they were. Yeah, they were very, 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 very nice guys. But I met this cat there, who was a had been invited to the meetup by a friend of his, who I think she was an anarchist, but he was really into the Ron Paul thing, and she had invited him to this thing, and she you know, one of Ron Paul's major positions is building a wall. Between America and Mexico, and the guy and I started talking about immigration, and this is really interesting because this guy was not some rich dude. He ran a really small landscaping business, and he had been personally impacted by his competitors in the area who did hire workers from Mexico who were quote unquote undocumented and were undercutting him, and he felt that sting. And what I told him was that, dude, you know, that sucks because you're, you know, quote unquote playing by the rules, and you're under, you know, like to a certain degree you're getting screwed in a business sense, but understand that the system itself is just completely and utterly retarded. You know, like this isn't about you know, stealing jobs and stuff like that. Just the very fact that we're restricting movement in the first place, that anyone would ever even think of doing that, is absolutely preposterous, and action like that creates huge imbalances in any occurring system, and it's not so much that it's not or not at all that immigration laws will in any way help stem that. In fact, immigration laws just increase that imbalance. That's one of the great ironies of the state, is that it'll start these policies that further create the very problem they're telling us and assuring us that they're solving. Okay, I'll just simply, immigration policy increases the likelihood of slavery. Okay, it's essentially what it is. It creates incentives for slave labor.
Sure, which is exactly, by the way, what the upper classes love. Let's not forget who benefits from slavery. It's definitely not the immigrants, and it's definitely not you or I either. The middle class does not benefit from this. It's a small percentage of the ruling elite that benefit greatly from this. So, why do you think NAFTA passed? You know, they want to make sure to keep trade open. So we can get their goods, so we can get their resources and steal all the resources from their country, and then, you know, then it'll demonize anybody in that country who's starving enough to want to come to this country to work and provide for the family.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the things you can look at is you can look at government trade sanctions between other countries. What they do is they create instability. You know, this is one of the main focal points of state capitalism specifically, is to create manageable amounts of instability in other areas so that you can profit off of it in terms of, you know what I mean, like building drug companies there that you can run very cheap, creating huge tracts of land for their beef and for fast food and that kind of thing. So immigration.
Well, I think that what people need to understand is why people would want to, right? You know, for instance, it makes light of it in that Onion clip about riding in the back of a melon truck. But I mean, this happens every day. I worked with two guys when I worked out on the ranch, who came in and they paid $1,500 a piece to ride in the back of a goods truck, stuffed between boxes of cheap plastic toys, where they rode for 14 hours, only to be taken out in the middle of nowhere in Arizona and kicked out of the truck and left on their own. And
yeah,
they did it. They've done it twice.
Something that's interesting is there's an activism. There's an activist organization that. Specifically, what they do is they look for people coming over the border and walking in Arizona and other bordering states where it gets really, really, really hot, and they give them food and water. That's what this activist organization does. And actually,
I used to work with a group that would leave bottles of water when I lived in Tucson. We would leave bottles of water in the desert, and I can't tell you how many bottles of water we left out there that had shotgun holes put into them by people like the Ron Paul supporters.
Well, and not to mention, laws were actually passed prohibiting that type of behavior, and there were a couple of activists who were actually arrested. And you know, let's think about that, people. Okay, let's think about it. Let's get rid of all the rhetoric, you know, just clear our minds for a minute and imagine someone getting taken and put into a cage for giving someone else food and water in the desert. Let's just think about that for just a second. Someone got put in a cage for giving food and water to a human being in the desert. We need puke sound. Okay, so let's think about it. You're walking through the desert. You're thirsty. You're hungry. Is it just you and somebody gives you water? Cop takes them away. You wish you could drink some water.
So what I mean, yeah, let's think about this. All the same people that you know hate the immigrants coming in, they absolutely love having tomatoes in January. You know, where do you think that's coming from, people? Your fruit and vegetables are illegal immigrants.
No shit.
You
should go to jail for buying them.
Yeah, and quite literally, actually, when you consider GMO crops and how, on large, the Mexican farmers have rejected Monsanto's GMO crops because they have seed banks of heirloom corn seeds that they've used for generations, and that's what the families are known for, is the different corns. It's much like the different patterns of flannels in Scotland. You know, it's your pattern is your family. It's your family mark, and the corn is very similar to that in Mexico. There were literally hundreds and hundreds of different types of corn that were being grown in Mexico, and GMO crops were resisted almost across the board by small Mexican farmers, by small families who have subsisted for hundreds and hundreds of years growing this particular strain of corn that family grows, and they're the only family that has that seed. Well, now GMO crops have somehow contaminated the fields, causing their crops of corn to be illegal. So quite literally, the food that we are importing is illegal food. I mean, it's stolen food. It's stolen by GMO companies who steal the lands from these workers, who then charge these workers with stealing the corn to sell, which is not even the corn they want to grow. It's the corn they have to grow now because the GMO has successfully invaded. So basically, let's look at a cornfield and see how the larger percentage of the invasive species has come in and is willing to work for less. The GMO corn will produce more for less, and it's taken over the workforce of the native corns that the Mexican farmers were growing. And so, you know, it's the same process. It's the exact same process. And so all of the food, and which, by the way, every bit of food we eat here has corn in it at some point, whether it's beef, chicken, doesn't matter. It's force-fed corn. And, you know, all the corn we grow in the U.S., of course, is used by biodiesel companies to sell it to the fucking Prius owners who use biodiesel because they're saving the earth by driving more with their biodiesel. So the corn that we eat comes from Mexico. So we have illegal immigrant corn.
And we should build a wall around our gardens to make sure that the illegal corn and vegetables don't grow into our shit. You know, it blows my mind. You know, I mean, like, you know, well, I mean, really, you know, it doesn't anymore. I mean, this is like, there's such huge incentives for these very few people at the top to do this kind of shit. And, you know, you embed it enough into...
Go ahead.
Well, you know, you embed it enough into the culture and people will become accepting of that type of stuff, or they'll just become completely ignorant. And, you know, another thing is that, you know, when I was in Arizona, I mean, it's just like the, the rampant racism against Mexicans is just like whoa, you know what I mean? Just like, especially, you know, again, for me, as someone who just so strongly opposes immigration, or I mean, I don't even like that word. I don't even like that fucking word. Just restricting people's movement and traveling for just such ridiculous shit as like nationalistic identity and capitalistic opportunities, it just kills me. But people will become really accepting of their food being produced by the very people that they wouldn't want to allow actually over here. And you know, a movie that I really recommend to everyone is it was made in Mexico, and it's called The Sleep Dealers. And it takes place in the very not-so-distant future, and it has to do with workers getting plugged into virtual reality shit so that they can operate robots in America. So that makes it
so
that... By the
way, we did see that movie. That was a really good movie.
Isn't it good?
Yeah, we took the recommendation. We went out and rented it. It was really good. We really liked it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and you know, it's I fucking... I mean, I buy it, dude. You know? Like, the whole thing with the dam and forcing people to put American money into a slot to buy water... You know, it was just like fucking crazy, man.
Yeah, but I mean, that's insane, because we all know the American dollar is going to shit, which is a really fun topic to talk about. I got a great one. So, you know, you got these right-wing extremists, Alex Jones types, that you know, the Glenn Beckians who are always promoting buying gold and silver, as if, you know, when shit hits the fan and you're starving, civilization is crumbling, you know, having a stockpile of gold and silver is really going to save your ass, because, I mean, nobody can understand the joys of cooking, like, you know, eating gold and silver to stay alive. But I have a friend who recently told me that when he was reading about all these reports about the dollar crumbling, he had a small panic attack and spent all of his tax returns that he had gotten, that he'd been saving up for some trip he wanted to take, or he didn't know what he was going to use it for. He invested in cigars, and he bought trunks of cigars because his thoughts were, his skewed, pot-smoked-out thought process was that CEOs out of work are going to be clamoring for their lifestyles, and they're going to be doing whatever he wants for a good cohiba.
Are you being serious? This actually, your friend, this guy, did he actually do this?
Oh, yeah. No, I'm dead serious. Yeah, he's got humidors. He lives in a small one-room apartment kind of thing, and he has humidors full of very expensive cigars.
And
at first I was thinking, God, that's retarded. Then I started thinking about it, and I was like, you know, it's actually quite brilliant. Because he's right. They are going to be clamoring for lifestyle. They're not going to be clamoring for essentials. People will do anything to maintain the semblance of the lifestyle that they once had.
You know, they'll put themselves, you know, further into the hole. I mean, one of the most, you know, interesting things going on right now is the number of homeless people who are actually working in the tech industry before this most recent depression in American economic history. And so you have these people who just, like, they got this money, and there was a bunch of easy money to be made, and they just really – they just blew their wad. They bought all this shit. And then when their market crashed, they realized they didn't have any – they didn't know how to do anything. And so now they're homeless, like literally on the streets. I mean, what a fucking, what a little switcheroo. You know, it's really interesting. I emailed Janiel Shulman, who we're going to be having on the show in the coming weeks.
I'd like to apologize to him right now for the hustle and bustle we've been tossing around the last couple weeks. He was supposed to be on the show last week. And
yeah, shit went down and Rob Rouser was moving. But he's a really, really nice guy, so he's totally cool with it. But I had emailed him. And asked him about, you know, the whole idea of getting into metals, like, you know, that's one of the things that happens in his book, is that people try to switch over and start using that. But anyway, and he actually emailed me back and he said, you know, honestly, the things that you want to really think about in the event of, like, you know, an utter collapse in America is really things that are actually usable, you know, like chairs and foods and, you know, growing food, learning how to grow food and learning how to do, you know, all these things that really the shit that's going to matter isn't going to be having a big pile of gold, because what the fuck does it matter if you have gold? You can't eat it. You can't drink it. You know, there's really no, you know, like,
By the way, people say, well, you could trade it because it's important for a lot of industries, you know, and that's going to be something that's going to be important to stuff. If we're at a point where civilization has collapsed to the point where your only bartering chip is gold and silver, those who want that gold and silver to use it are going to take it from you. they're not going to give you a fair deal. Has anybody not seen The Postman with Kevin Costner? Am I the only one that watched that movie?
Actually, yeah, I think you are. Because it's a fucking piece of shit from whatever. It was made already, man.
Well, you know, my friend Grady was an extra in that movie, and he said Kevin Costner came on set one day and gave all the extras a big pep talk, you know, about the film. And the, Kevin Costner said, "Is there any questions?" And my friend Grady raised his hand and said, "Yeah, is this one going to bomb as bad as Waterworld did?" That such goes the tale. I'm not sure exactly how that
so
played out, but.
So we have Liberty Pyle in the chat room right now, and he says,
"Is he going to defend The Postman? Because it's actually a pretty decent movie. I liked it.
I haven't seen it. All I know is made in Oregon. It was terrible. That's all I heard. I kind of want to see it though. I mean, I actually don't hate Kevin Costner as much as other people. Okay, so Liberty Pyle says, actually, in economies that collapse, commodities always become the medium of exchange. If food is not in short supply." See Argentina in 2001. And then he says, whether it is gold or silver or something else doesn't matter too much. Ammunition is also popular.
Yeah, tell Liberty Power, we're not merely speaking about the collapse of the American economy. That's already done. We are in the downward spiral of a collapse of the American economy. People don't seem to understand that when an economy collapses, it doesn't just collapse overnight. At times it does. For instance, Argentina in 2005, overnight the bankers closed out all of the funds for the people that had invested in those banks, and the economy literally came to a screeching halt overnight. However, in most cases, with most economies through history, economies crash not with a bang but with a whimper. They go out really slowly, and what eventually happens is outside forces come in and purchase up large percentages of the commodities and resources of said economy. Which hence the IMF, the World Bank, these organizations come in and, you know, offer economic incentives to become a part of their organization, and they end up purchasing up larger and larger amounts until they can have a complete takeover, and the economy then is closed out from what it normally had been known to be prior to this slow crash. And this is a slow crash that we're in the downward spiral of. It's not going to be saved. Obama's not going to save this economy. What Obama's job is at this point is to lessen the blow to the larger percentage of the people so they become more comfortable with the ideas of one world economy and one world government. I mean, that's his whole his entire purpose of being in office is to put a kinder face on capitalism, because this is not failed capitalism. This is the end result of capitalism. This is what capitalism does.
I disagree. I think that's a very specific kind of capitalism, ergo state capitalism.
Oh man, we're not going to debate the names of cupcakes right now, are we?
But you have to have your terms. I mean, because I to say, you know, that's like me saying that. That's making a blanket statement about socialism, saying that you know, the on the opposite spectrum, you can say no. Barack Obama's putting a friendlier face on aggressive socialism, and then I would say jump in and say I would say
I agree. Hear me out.
I'm just saying that I think that there is a distinction between capitalism and socialism, and state capitalism and state socialism. They're distinct. It's important to talk about that because we don't know
what we're talking about, the ethos of state capitalism or the ethos of state socialism, because those are very distinct and those are very, very different. I'm talking about the end game, the end result of state socialism, the end result of state capitalism. It all results in power streaming overwhelmingly from the bottom, taken out, and going directly to the top. And that's the end result of both capitalism and socialism. And that's the point of it. Anytime the economy is involved with power, well, anytime economy gets involved with power, power uses the economy as a tool of power and a tool of control, because controlling the economy is not controlling the people. It's merely a tool to control the people. That's why we have so many other aspects of control in our life. If it was merely about control and the economy was the only way to control the people, we would have the chips in our arms long ago, and everything would be hunkered down on sales. And I mean, that everything would revolve around that. But that's just not the case. I mean, we do have the wild card of human imagination here.
Well, yeah, but you know, I absolutely agree with you. But what I'm trying to specifically point out is what I'm always trying to point out, and that's what things look like when the state is present and what things look like when the state is not present. And for thousands of years, we have indigenous cultures. I mean, they were fucking like Native American fucking nations in the North American land. They interacted with each other. They exchanged. They traded with each other.
Yeah, but give up the ghost, Travis. That's not capitalism. That's not capitalism.
Look, all capitalism is maintaining something and putting it back into your community or your organization to keep it going. State capitalism is a system that's specifically driven by greed, which is what Adam Smith described as a mental sickness. Because that's
no. You have to break it down to its root. Capitalism, in and of itself, creates capital. Capital being a substitution for whatever diverse amount of resources you have, it all gets broken down into one word. It simplifies and groups everything into this one term of capital, thereby making everything a commodity, which is very different from other barter-type economies. Not everything is a commodity in barter economies. For instance, the native people of this land had no concept of buying and selling of land because that wasn't a commodity, even though they had a barter system and a free market system, according to a lot of ideas of what the free market may be. Capitalism specifically in and of itself creates profit where profit did not previously exist, and it creates of that profit a commodity of a resource which was once not a commodity, rather a useful part of daily living.
And what I'm saying
is
that
once a useful part of daily living becomes a commodity, it then becomes available for trade at any and all costs. And that's a vital difference to understand between barter economies and capitalist economies. I understand that people want to put this nice face on capitalism, like, well, all capitalism means is just trading things. Like, we're not talking about magic cards here.
No, I didn't say that capitalism is about trading things. Capitalism in a non-aggressive environment is about, and here's the thing, these tribes behaved capitalistically, i.e., they saved what they needed to and put it right back into their community. That's you know, capitalism in the context of now is a system wherein you compile huge piles of non-commodities, which is like could be food, it could be fucking sandals, it could be whatever. You could be stockpiling furs to get you through the winter. That's building up capital for future profit. That future profit in the context of then in a stainless environment.
Capitalism is a society based around those commodities. That's what capitalism is. That's why it would have the term. The capitalism is basically it's the religion of, or the belief in the focus on commodity, or
come on,
focus
man, that
on
is,
capital.
You don't think that's just like a painfully broad collectivistic kind of a statement? I mean, you know I think it's disingenuous to say here's what it is that, you know. And again, and I take that same exact position when someone, you know, uses a broad statement. Well, all socialism is just controlling everybody. I disagree. I don't think that's what socialism is at all. I think that's a really broad statement. I think the collection of capital applies also to very, you know, like tribal shit, like, you know, so, building up stuff to get you through the winter. You know, that's saving
but
up capital to achieve future profit, which is survival. Now,
the inherent problem is the viewpoint that's taken from is a very Western capitalistic viewpoint that these people's entire lives were based around the collection of these goods.
I never said their lives were about that. I'm just said that what I'm talking about is capitalism as just a behavior. It's just a mechanic. Now, of course, it's from a Western perspective. I'm a fucking American. I'm gonna put all my concepts through that too. But it doesn't mean that I'm saying that they were after profit and trying to make money, because I think that the drive towards greed is a mental sickness, and you know, that's very apparently not very Western for me to think. Greed's apparently an okay thing in state capitalism. We've got quotes from CEOs saying greed is a great thing. I don't think these people were greedy, and I don't think they had words like commodity. Yeah, that's all Western language and Western concepts. I'm merely describing what they did is very similar to what we do. The biggest difference with us is that we have built this huge thing called civilization. We have built this huge thing called the state, which did not emerge in their communities. So if we look at those communities and we see that that model didn't emerge, it didn't mean that they were wildly different than us. It didn't mean that they didn't save shit up for future gain. The future gain, of course, just being the survival. And they didn't think of it that way. Yeah, they didn't have any of those words. And yeah, they didn't. Yeah, of course they didn't, because they were free.
I think it's unfair, and I think it's colonialistic to place the term capitalism upon their way of life and their way of survival, their way of economy, simply because it may suit to serve the definition for today to create a new definition or a new face of capitalism. Let's look at capitalism for what it is. Capitalism is white supremacy. Capitalism is murder.
But it is.
But that's all it's ever been.
I disagree completely. I think that, you know what it is? It's like when the evolutionary scientist steps forward and says, you know what, I believe in evolution, and I've concluded that there is no God. And then for the religious fundamentalists to turn around and say, see, evolution teaches there is no God. Because there have been white supremacists in the world, powerful people who have done terrible, terrible things, that's not this blanket, I mean, to make a blanket statement that capitalism is a system used by white supremacists, dude, that's like saying guns are something.
There's a vital difference in language here between a system used by white supremacists and a system of white supremacy. White supremacy is very different than the white supremacists that come to mind when we think about it. White supremacy is something that's thousands of years old, and it's based and rooted in the systems of capitalism and socialism and communism, and any way to control the people's economies. Period.
These are all state things. And Alvarez, I just want to be clear that every single context that you're going to be able to bring up is all embedded in the state, which is a very specific kind of social organization, which has been around for thousands of years and was created by
all economies in the history of Western civilization, which is the context in which we're speaking, is rooted in. All economies in Western civilization have been rooted in the state. There's never been a single economy that has survived when the state has been involved, and the state has been involved since the inception of Western civilization.
Right, right, absolutely.
We're going back to Platonic times at this point.
Totally agree.
So thereby, here go, or get, use the term here. So ergo, capitalism is a tool of the state, period.
Absolutely.
In Western civilization, religion is a tool of the state.
Absolutely.
There hasn't been a single major religion that has written, and I state again, a single major religion that has come into rise since the inception of the state, which has not been used by the state.
By the way, listeners, that reminds me, thank you, Rabble Rouser. Have you seen Mr. Deity? I highly recommend it to everybody. Liberty Pyle turned me onto this. It's fucking this web series where this kind of effeminate gray hair, and he looks like a Hollywood movie producer. He kind of looks like George Lucas. He plays God, and it's kind of the day in, day out travails of God, starting with creation and on and on.
He looks like George Lucas.
He looks like George Lucas, the guy who
plays. He's kind of a ratty looking guy, like a fat
no-neck rat. Yeah, he's got gray hair, and he's got like a little piercing, and they're making the universe. And his assistant is like, we're just going through the things that you're going to allow and the things you're not going to allow. And he's like, Holocaust, and God's like, yeah, let's keep him. He goes, okay.
How much George Lucas looks like an Ewok these days?
Dude, he does. Did you see the drunk Ewoks on the Today Show the other day? They all dressed up on Halloween.
Man, I haven't had any contact with any kind of technological civilization for fucking weeks now.
Dude, the Today Show on Halloween all dressed up like Star Wars. And they even hired and exploited a couple of midgets who they got drunk and dressed them up like Ewoks. And they were moonwalking. One of them humped Al Roker's leg. Unreal. I'm really not
joking. Exploiting who at this point?
Unreal.
I'm going to hump his leg. I don't give a shit. Fuck that fat bastard.
Let's see. Okay, Liberty Files feedback is... okay, let's see.
With a name like Liberty Pyle, I know he's going to support the market. Here we go. He or she.
He says, basic capitalism, free ownership of the means of production. This is where lots of people go wrong. Capital in the economic sense means of production, e.g. stuff. I think you guys should change the name of the show to the Philosophical Definition Comedy Hour.
Well, here's the thing. Here's the vital difference that we need to set forth here is that I don't give a shit about production, because production inherently means that our lives are based around producing something, and that's not what we are meant to do. What we are meant to produce is shit. We are built as animal constructs to produce excrement. Other than that, we are not meant to be producers. We are meant to merely live. And that's where when we talk about economies in any way, that's where it all goes haywire for me, is that people actually vest themselves into these ideas of production. And by the way, I am a union member. I'm a Wobbly. I'm a very proud member of the IWW, and I hate work. And I will fight work till the day that I die, because work is the thievery of life. Quite simple. It's the creation of a time-based life, which, as we all know, working on a calendar or a clock is an inherent thievery of free will, number one. Number two, to talk about control of the means of production is to say that you have domain of some sort over the earth. You have control over the means of survival for not just yourself, but for others as well, which is slavery. So I don't want to say that I would ever support any ideas that support these things, and that's exactly what all economies support, especially ones that talk about control of the means of production.
That's ridiculous, man, because, yeah, well, not ridiculous. That's not nice. That's not nice. That's not appropriate. Not
yourself,
mature.
Fool.
I think to live is to, if you go out and you plant some food in your backyard, you're producing. It's just a fucking word, man. Living is making, you know, like when indigenous cultures, when they built fucking like huts to live in, they're producing shit. Now, it's just fucking vocabulary, and it depends on how one uses the vocabulary.
Are you seriously going to go with that argument that it's just, it all comes down to semantics?
Well,
because there are deep implications in the language.
No, dude, I'm not going to say it's just down to semantics, but I am going to say that we need to be very specific about what kind of production we're talking about. Like, because, you know, I'm along, rabble rouser, I'm along with you through so much of it until I'm like, well, but what are you going to tell me? You're just going to shit, and you're never going to make anything. Of course not. If you're creative, you know, and you make
music. No. But we're talking about for an economy. But we're talking about economically. So we're talking about not producing something for ourselves. We're talking about producing something that's a valid and valuable economic resource. Production in and of itself is something completely different than an economically based production, and we both know that. So it's not.
No, I disagree, because we're talking about this whole like the subjective theory of value and what is valuable. I mean, if
dude, when I tack a sheet to the wall and make a tent for my kids, I'm not doing something that's capitalistic, socialistic, barteristic. I'm simply creating something out of the resources that I have at hand. But that's not for sale, so it has nothing to do. It completely exists outside of the guidelines of the economy. Completely.
Dude, look, at its most abstract, an economy, or even at most abstract, the word market is a socioeconomic system of interactions and exchanges. And when you start getting more specific, you start getting into certain kinds of exchanges and certain kinds of interactions and what those entail and what the implications of those are. So if a tribal community has a fucking economy. Okay, it has a very specific kind of economy. Okay, I'm not saying it doesn't have a capitalistic one. It has a very
I'd be careful about that. I wouldn't say it has a specific kind of economy, because it varies. Maybe specific for its particular tribe, but that's the problem, is that when discussing theory, a lot of people want to tend to lump all of these things into a one size fits all, and. So, you can't do that when it comes to tribalistic communities, because there is no one.
No, I know.
And
rabble rouser. I mean, I don't mean to seem like I'm doing that, because I really have no intention of saying that. Here's how the tribals all behave. They were savages and they ate hearts.
Right. But they were capitalists because they saved their shit and survived through the winter. The fact that they survived through the winter proves that they are capitalists. Boom, I win. Where's my door prize?
So, hey, you hit on something that I actually really wanted to talk about tonight, and has really been coming up to me in my mind
door
a lot the past 2 weeks, is you just talked about, you mentioned that we're this search for one-size-fits-all type of description or social implication, and by no means was I, you know, like, not every tribe saved things like that. I'm just saying that there were tribes that did, and
yeah,
I was
absolutely,
just
there were there were tribes there are many tribes that existed nomadically and followed the herds and existed
right, exactly,
almost
exactly,
completely
exactly.
off of a meat-based diet.
Exactly,
boggles the mind that they didn't die at the age of 35 of coronary illnesses.
I will not in any way deny that there was a rich, rich, rich tapestry of different social systems and ways of doing things and ways of knowing and ways of living.
And I do want to say, before we go on, Before we go on, I do want to say that I feel really silly even talking about economies when it comes to these things, because we talk about them as if they're important to know and understand. These things were not important to the people of that time. They didn't have economic theorists sitting around talking about pelts and seed banks.
Well, but,
I mean, they,
you know what?
They just didn't, because they only worked for 2 hours a day.
Yeah, they're important to talk about now because we're so far removed from interactions and exchanges that should be quite natural, that we shouldn't have to think about so much. And we've, you know, this is, you know, where you and I start to converge in our hatred of civilization, is that it's completely removed us from these, compartmentalized us. I mean, I cringe as I use a lot of, you know, I'm constantly thinking about all the different, like, nuances I'm looking at and the little niches and the things, and I'm like, fuck, man, you know, that's crazy. Like, these are all things that, in my opinion, you know, normal interactions and exchanges, that were a given, you know, so that were a given then, that we didn't have to think about because, again, the corporate state is not something that emerges naturally in a tribal system. It's got to be really hoisted and forced, and we don't see, the state is something that was an experiment tried a few times through, quote-unquote, prehistory, and it collapsed and people walked away from it, and now we just doggedly stick to it, and we become so far removed that we, you know, if it collapsed, like, you know, like, could we, you know, would we walk away from it, and could we, or would we all perish? But I wanted to talk about something that it's been, and I want to play a clip that.
Well, before you play the clip, can I say something going on what you said?
Yeah, please. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think that's why it's so important for us as a show. You know, Liberty Pile, I know, was joking when they said we should call it the Philosophical Comedy Hour. But I do want to note that it's very important to me that not just on the show, but in our lives, we stop spending so much time on philosophical debates. Philosophy is great for the coffee shop. It's great for around the dinner table. But outside of the context of light conversation or even deep, ear-shredding conversation between friends, it requires a life based in action. That's what anarchism requires of us, because anarchy at its root requires, the number one thing that anarchy requires is personal responsibility and accountability. You have to be extremely responsible and extremely accountable to yourself and to your ideals, and that requires action. And that doesn't just look like bricks through windows. I'm tired of every time I say the word action, somebody automatically assumes that I'm talking about some kind of destructive force. Not to say that those things aren't important, but I'm talking merely about the actions that we take on a daily basis and implementing these ideas that we get at the dinner table, that we get on Burn while we're discussing these things, and that we get at the coffee shop, implementing them for real in your life. And I want to make sure that we focus a large part of our show talking about the people who are doing those things, not just about the ideas historically speaking, because I think we get caught up in the historical societies, and I don't want to talk about those things too much, because I think it's inherently fallible. Number one, we don't have the truth. We in no way have the real accounts of how people live. We have a very broad, very white supremacist account of how people lived all through history.
Sure.
So it's hard for us to actually discuss that intelligently. And it's fun. It's fun to debate philosophy, and it's a good time. But I want to make sure that the people that are listening now, especially if you're a first-time listener, understand that this is not the focus of Burn, is to debate philosophies. It's more to be a fun time to talk about the actions that are taking place around the world, and then have a good time poking at each other over philosophies, because we do have divergent philosophies. And when civilization collapses, I will eat you. And
I will eat your fucking liver, because that's going to be the richest part. You know, probably get me fucking high.
Right.
Liver
right.
will
and,
become
and,
the
and,
new heroin.
But the truth is, you would probably trade me, and that's fine.
So over the past 2 weeks, I have been on this reflection about anarchism, and I frequent this website called Free Agents. It's fr33agents.com, and one word, and it's where it's kind of an anarchist hub. There's a lot of people on the market end of things, of different, very variety of different stripes. I mean, it's a very diverse school of thought, and there's this one asshole on this site, fucking kid, he is a self-proclaimed, and I hope he's fucking listening. What an asshole! He's a fucking anarcho neoconservative. And he argues in favor of military interventionism and, the slow elimination. You know, he really signs on for this thing called gradualism, which is essentially a way to perpetuate the state while telling yourself that you're gradually whittling it away, when in fact all you're doing is perpetuating it. And by the way, folks, anybody who subscribes to such a thing as slowly doing away with the state, I'm sorry, it doesn't work that way. The state is not the type of organization that's going to just go, oh, you want us to give up power? Okay, you should have just said so, because we're happy.
Right.
No, that's not the way it fucking works. And so I've been on this thing, and, you know, when he writes these long things about how society should be and how it should behave and what's the best thing for everyone, and this is what made me, you know, think of this when we had mentioned this idea of enforcing this one-size-fits-all thing, but I realized that anarchists, and I will say a great many anarchists, don't want anarchy. And by anarchy, I mean just a free society. I think that what we're dealing with in this movement, I think that this is a big, big disease in the movement, is people who want the world to be in a very specific fashion. You know, whether you got the fucking hardcore, like, anarcho-syndicalists who's like, here's the federations and there'll be giant regional ones and this is how we'll do it and this is how the world, and this is who will rule. It's not about being free. It's not about saying, hey, man, you live how you want to live. I'm going to live how I want to live, and let's not force one another. I think that can work, and I think that it has worked in history. And I'm onto this thing about I don't think many anarchists actually want a free society. They just want things to be the way they want them to be. And so I have this great clip from Alan Moore where he was kind enough to define anarchy and to talk about it a little bit. I thought it was fucking cool, and I'd never actually seen him speak anywhere. And,
oh, you know what's great about Alan Moore, too? He's not only an anarchist and an amazing writer and amazing illustrator, he's a certified warlock. It's awesome.
So sick. All right, so here we go.
So awesome,
Alan Moore.
Dude.
Alan Moore on anarchy.
Anarchy is, and always has been, a romance. It is clearly the best way and the only morally sensible way to run the world. That everybody should be the master of their own destiny. Everybody should be their own leader. This is something that I still believe. I think that even a cursory look around the world at the moment, particularly at the moment, would reveal that it is about 0.00001% of the world's population that causes 99.99999% of the world's problems. And that tiny percentage, it's not the Jewish banking conspiracy. It's not the asylum seekers. It's not the secret homosexual conspiracy running Hollywood. It's not even the Scientologists. It is leaders. But what we need is an administration, at most. We don't need people to boss us about.
All right, and that was Alan Moore on anarchy. I think I'm with him until, I don't know, what do you think of the statement, what we need is administration at most? What do you think that means?
I think what he means by the term administration is actually the High English word administration, which also could equal out to the word federation, which is a self-appointed, but group-appointed through consensus councils of people to come together that would discuss problems or discuss issues at hand, but not to decide or to create any kind of rules or regulations, just to come to a term based upon their tribal or their regional needs, which, you know, I think those ideas work great. Because, I mean, I don't know, G20, if you've ever been involved in a consensus meeting, but I've been involved in more than I care to talk about.
no,
and
I haven't.
They're ranging from very important issues as to what should we do with the small amount of money that we have, and this is what we have to spend it on, this is how we have to get food, we have to do this. Those are important issues. All the way down to I've been involved with consensus meetings about what color of paper to use for flyers or signs, and we want to be culturally sensitive with the language worded on this thing and this thing. And it just, I mean, it gets to the point where it's ridiculous. I for one would never want to be a part of the Federation meetings because those consensus meetings are long and boring and dull. Unfortunately, that's what we have to go through when we're trying to coexist or sub-exist within this system in which we live in. And, you know, the other thing that, I've learned from those consensus meetings, though, that I think is very important as a lesson, is to learn that everything doesn't have to be rushed, and we don't have to make these decisions right away, that we need to be able to take time, because time is ours, and we have that time. We have these lives, and we can take as much time as we want to say something, and we can take as much time as we need to figure out something. I just don't want to be the motherfucker doing it, because I don't. You know, I paint the wall whatever color you fucking want. If I don't like it, I'll paint over it later.
Dude, I went, okay, so I was like 19, and I was a fucking huge hippie, and I went to this fucking consensus meeting planning thing for the regional rainbow gathering, and
that's awesome.
So they're passing around a bucket, okay? Now, and I'm not talking about like a wicker basket plate thing. Literally a cleaned out fucking like big giant white paint bucket of some sort filled with this fucking like granola ganja food. And they pass this thing around and and I remember I was 19 and I was like, oh, man, I'm going to go help like plan the next thing, right? I'm going to go help plan it. And it was the most boring fucking thing, especially when hippies are getting really, really stoned on ganja food, and they're trying to come to a consensus with, like, 40 people. It's brutal. It's brutal.
Can we get, like, can I get, like, a group
Yeah, no shit. No.
I think we really need to pull it back in here. We're kind of straying, man. What the fuck are we talking about?
No. But I wanted to ask you about this, Rabble Rouser, because, you know, we talk a lot about, you know, actions. And for me, I'm
okay,
an
wait,
ideas.
Okay, wait. Give me 1 second before you ask. I need to take my shirt off. Please.
All right. Awesome.
Hold on.
So listeners, we're talking about action. And we're talking about.
Sorry, it's off.
Kind of. That's so sexy, too. Are you, like, totally naked, shirtless?
No, I'm actually down to my baseball-style tee, three-quarter-length sleeve, holy, holy, holy t-shirt, which are no longer available on the market anymore, but I'm sitting in front of my fire, which I built Survivor Man style with wet twigs, by the way, and now it's so rocking that I had to take my sweater off. So
Wet twigs in a donut box. That's fucking, that's industrious. So do you,
what
I
do you
want to ask
that?
You. Do you think that, I mean, do you think that there's a sizable element of just very narrow thinking anarchists who essentially want a world order of their design? I mean, do you ever get that sense of there's not, for me, it's people should, you know, as Alan Moore said, I think that people should be their own master, and you should be able to opt in and opt out of a community and, you know, live in a type of community that you want to, as long as you're not hurting others and forcing them to live your ways. But I don't find a lot of that, this idea of diversity amongst communities. I just find
it
kind of hard. Go ahead.
Well, go ahead and say what you found, actually.
Oh, I was just going to say, I just find a strain of, here's how things should be for everybody. This is what will work best for this asshole on free agents. It's just free market capitalism is the way that it has to happen. This is the best way to facilitate everything, peace and everything for everybody. I'm just like, that's fucking stupid, you know, like, and I feel that same way. I interacted with another kid once who said that, no, it's syndicalism with the federations. That's the thing that we have to try and get everybody to be doing. And I think that thinking globally has become really detrimental to movements where we're thinking in terms of this is how everyone should live. And really it's how you should live. Like, I want a society wherein the syndicalists can live that way. I want that, maybe. And if I don't want to sign on for that, I'll go sign on for something else, and I don't expect them to, you know, vice versa. That's the kind of world that I want to live in.
Yeah, I think what we need to understand is that I've come to learn in my travels around the country, you know, being in a band is something that I started doing when I was really young that really, you know, it's almost like being in the military because it's like, well, you know, I joined for the benefits and so I could travel and so I could meet people. You know, it was awesome.
Right.
But it's what I did. And being in Holy, Holy, Holy gave me the opportunity because we almost exclusively chose to play anarchist collectives and different forms of collective living situations, whether they're explicitly anarchist or just kind of exist under anarchist terms, even accidentally. We wanted to be a part of this around the country to see what was going on, number one. But number two, the major reason we went was almost like a missionary mission of bringing to a stop these ideas of control and my way is the right way and I have the answers, because we don't. We don't have the answers. We have a lot of fucking questions. We have a lot of anger. But until we start understanding how to act out of necessity instead of out of philosophy or ideology, we will never get to a point of true freedom. Because when you act out of necessity, you are acting in a way that your primal instincts have an ability to meet their way through the years of garbage that we've been fed by the system in which we live. And I hate using that term, the system, because it sounds like, you know, classic. It's the system, man. But honestly, you know, I know more corporate logos than I do indigenous plants in my region, as does everybody else you'll ever talk
right.
to. You know, it's just that simple. I've been force-fed garbage. So I have to learn to allow my primal instincts to somehow start fostering themselves, and you do that by acting out of necessity. Now, when you're acting out of ideology, it's impossible to act out of necessity because you're towing a party plan. Whether it's anarchistic, socialistic, communistic, it doesn't matter. It becomes religion. You're acting in a way that's unnatural to yourself. And furthermore, you know, there's a progression involved here. This is definite progression. When I first got into anarchist ideas, I was all about, you know, the various strains have gone. I've gone through the various strains. And, you know, I respect all of those. I respect that natural progression of just wanting to smash it all to understanding that, well, maybe we should build something now and then smash that stuff at the same time, to the point now where I'm like, you know what, we got to smash everything and just live off the land, because that's really the only thing that could possibly make sense. And it's true. To me, that's the only thing that at this point is going to ever make sense. Now, I'm not saying that I'm right. I'm just saying that's the only thing that makes sense to me at this point. In my
Liberty Pyle has a question in the chat room. He's asking, you're advocating getting back to a state of nature where might makes right and violence rules all. I'm not sure I understand where you're coming from.
See, that's the problem. That's what we've been taught that our nature is. We've been taught that our nature is an inherently might makes right violent system in a violent situation. We forget to understand that the effeminate qualities and the qualities of nurturing and love are just as strong and just as powerful and even more prevalent in the history of all species than the presence of might and the presence of strength. What we understand is the brute force mentality of systems of chaos, control, and destruction. And so that's all we can grasp, is that's what nature means. In fact, we've come to the point where we say that somebody is acting wild when they act in an obtuse way, when they act in a way that's uncontrollable and violent and disgusting. We say, oh, he's a wild beast. We forget to think about wild things also grow, and wild things coexist. Wild things come together in ways that create such vast beauty that camera crews fucking fly into the wild to get these shots because they're just so amazing they have to show them to civilization. You know, we forget that acting according to our instincts means more than not loving, caring, nurturing, self-preserving. Preserving and self-preservation in nature inherently means preserving those and that which is around you. Because if without your surroundings, you will not survive.
And yeah, I just finished a book called it's by this guy Michael Shermer. It's called The Mind of the Market. He talks about the hunter-gatherer tribes of antiquity. Technically is a getting back to nature kind of state, technically, and that in fact mutualism and cooperation are a very natural natural result of evolution. So I think really to get back to nature I imagine a kind of a modern day tribalism. I think that, you know, if we were to bring down the corporate and state classes, when we bring down the corporate and political classes, what we'll have is small communities, interdependent, cooperating mutually. And I don't think it's this high moralism, and I'm talking about cooperating in all the levels of love and compassion and help and friendship and all these wonderful things. Looking at it more abstractly, it's what animals like us do. This book talks about how our primate cousins have interactions and exchanges that are mutual aid, that are cooperation, that you know, they've done studies where the two monkeys who are put into a situation where they have to help one another to get to some food, where they have to work together to get to a piece of food, end up having a great relationship in terms, you know, in the way that monkeys have relationships. Their disputes are resolved rapidly, and that's because it is in our nature to cooperate. Yes, we do have violent tendencies, and yes, we do fight. Tribes were not utopian. They sometimes fought. But for the most part, when they interacted, it was peaceful because, for the most part, we're social cooperative animals, and that's how we are for the most part. And so I don't think to get back to nature is a return of violence and might through. I disagree with Liberty File on that. I don't think getting back to nature is that. I think getting back to nature is right. An environment where we actually, and like you said, rabble-rouser, through necessity, you know, go across the street and knock on the door and meet our neighbor and say, hey, we have to work together now directly. We're meeting. That's
and
good.
Let's look at it for what it is. Let's look at it honestly for what it is. We have 6,000 years of documented history. And in those 6,000 years of documented history, we have the slow building of this civilization that exists to destroy. Now, we have 150 to 200,000 years of found evidence of human existence, not just, I mean, we're talking millions of years of animal existence, but
yeah.
150 to 1,000 to 200,000 years of human existence on this planet. Now, in the past 250 years, we've managed to fuck this planet up to a point where this planet might not survive another 1,000 years in a way that we could cohabitate with this planet. So, people want to say that this is human nature. Well, I don't understand how human nature takes 200,000 odd years to come into play to the point where it's human nature to be destructive, because that's not human nature. What has happened is there's been a shift, some sort of a shift, I don't know what kind of shift it is, where a few diseased beings come into power, which is an odd idea anyway, this centralized some kind of a gathered power source controlling the rest of humanity. And that in itself has created this destruction. Human nature is resistant to that. And if you don't believe me, hang out with a 3-year-old and tell them what to do when they don't want to. And that is nature. I mean, we're talking about children. Every baby is born a caveman. Every baby is born with primal instincts. And in the time that they're from their baby until they're 10 years old, they're inundated with cultural bullshit that teaches them to act the way we want them to act. But given to themselves, every child is an animal. Every child is a primal animal. And you want to talk about resistance. That, to me, that's the number one human aspect that is above and beyond every other characteristic of any living being. The most common characteristic that humans share is our ability to resist. And we forget that because we've had that pushed out of us since day one. Don't resist. Stop resisting. Buy into this. Buy into that. Shop here. Eat this. Do that. Go to work. Go to sleep. Shut the fuck up. Talk up. You know, whatever it is, we've been told how to live and how to act and then told what our nature is. We've been told from on top what our nature is. And if you study, if you read any writings by colonialized peoples, there's some interesting ones. I saw a lady speak who was Filipino, and she was, she's the daughter, she's quite old, and she was the daughter of people who were colonialized when colonialization was happening. And these people said, this is interesting. What happened to us is that white Western civilization, Americans, came in, and they didn't take over by might right away. They studied us. They spent time with us. They engendered themselves with us. They endeared themselves to us. And then they told us who we were. And we were so enamored with the idea because we had never put a mirror to ourselves as a society to look at ourselves and examine. We were just surviving. We were living. That now we were being told who we were, and it was all wrong, but we accepted it. And that's the first step of colonialization, is to accept the definition of who you are by the outside forces. Now, if we take that down to a primal level, from birth on up, every bit of our lives in this culture, I'm standing on concrete, talking on a cell phone, smoking a cigarette, wearing clothes at a house, I've been told who I am. And we forget who we are, and those who have told us who we are tell us who we were born to be. They tell us that, well, you know, in the wild, you were a savage beast who is made of violence and made of aggression. And we've evolved past that. So that's why we give you roads, concretes, cars, and wars, because we've evolved. Yeah, it baffles the mind.
Yeah, I mean, because it's the whole, like, Daniel Quinn thing where he talks about, you know, I'm, you know, like both Rabble Rouser and I, we're both really down for creativity and art and making things. And, you know, that's all really cool stuff. Human creativity and ingenuity is a really cool, you know, product of evolution for the human animal. And I think that in a context of civilization, where people became, you know, populations exponentially rose, human minds became exponentially concentrated, and people made stuff at a rapider rate, that became the illusion for what we're doing is what we're ultimately meant for. Now, personally, I think we are meant to build neat things and do some really interesting things. I mean, that's what evolution gave us was our brains, and I totally sign on to that. Civilization is a skewing of that. Civilization is what happens in evolution when a population becomes really, really imbalanced. And the thing with our population becoming really, really imbalanced is, and this is in part, it's kind of the double-edged sword of the gifts of our brain that nature gave us, is that we've rationalized it and said, well, we've made all these bridges and roads and things, and therefore, this is the way things have to be. This is the natural trend. This is the way things are supposed to be, and we completely disregard, you know, what, 200,000 years of, you know, 200,000 years of existence where we made stuff then, too. We made all sorts of shit. Dude, I just finished a book recently called Seeds of Plenty, Stones of Change. And some motherfuckers took some gadgets out, and they went to really old sites, like old Mayan temples, Native American, like, man-made mounds and shit. And they measured some of these sites and found that some of the older ones, the really old ones, and the Native American mounds almost always exhibited this, and some of the sites in the Mayan areas exhibit this, they found a really high, high, high concentration of electromagnetic energy, right?
Yeah.
And then they took seeds and exposed them to this incredibly concentrated spot of electromagnetic energy. And then
seeds, like in plant seeds?
Yeah, and found that exposure, and they've been able to replicate this in the lab. They've taken, like, lab, you know, in the lab, they'll take seeds and blast them with electromagnetic energy and then grow them next to ones that they didn't do that to, and they find increased yield, increased growth and stuff. So they took seeds and did the same test at these sites and found that they had increased growth. The hypothesis being that these people of ancient times didn't build these things for their egos. They built them for practical reasons. And my whole point is that the indigenous people of North America gathered together dirt and fucking pebbles and rocks and piled them up into a mound and made a fucking power conductor, okay? So people make shit. People make really cool shit.
Well,
and when my imagination gets going and I think about the kind of stuff that we could have made, if we hadn't gone the direction of civilization, like what are the possibilities? Like free energy, like really crazy shit that we just make with fucking twigs. You know, like the possibilities were really endless. But you know, at this point, we won't know. But I mean,
we were in constant communication with every living force around us. I mean, this idea of five senses is one that's relatively new as well. I mean,
totally.
You don't want to
Go ahead.
No, go ahead. I was supposed to interrupt. You're being kind this time. You keep letting me speak. You're not interrupting.
I know. You know, because I used to be like I used to get into these really shit. And this is something that when we talk about on the show about sharing ideas with people, I used to be, you know, and this is like I used to be. I mean, within the past couple of years, when I first really started getting into radical ideas and in general, I used to get into a lot of shouting matches. And I, you know, just get really fired up and not really know what I was talking about and getting these shouting matches. And it really creates a hurtful environment. And so now I've gotten into this thing where I'm like, no. I want to be super respectful because it's really easy when we get passionate about ideas to become dicks. And so I'm striving.
I'm sensing some protection here, G20.
No. I am striving to be a dick. Because my friend, I remember, dude, no, I'll never forget this. And the template for this goes out to my buddy. He knows who he is. We were on a camping trip, and I started to go off about market anarchy and just anarchy in general. And, you know, he's a very, very intelligent person, and he has a very strong personality as well. And just the angrier I got, the mellower he got, you know what I mean? And the more fired up I got, the cleverer he got, you know what I mean? It was one of those things where he was just better at all of this than me. And we're actually really good friends, and I was yelling, and I was just carrying on and stuff, and you know, 2 years later, we still talk about that, and he's just like, man, I don't want to have any of these kind of conversations with you because I don't want to fight with you because I care about you. And that's really had a huge impression on me because I just don't, you know, I just don't want to be that guy. Anyway, what I was going to say, dude, I am so stoned right now. You know how many bowls I've smoked since we started the show, by the way? Fucking wrapped. Anyway, I was just going to say, imagine what it was like for them. Imagine a world without white noise. Imagine what did things sound like? You know, like, no wonder they were able to pick up hot spots of electromagnetic energy, dude. Their fucking hairs would stand up on end. Imagine being that sensitive. You know,
right.
World around
that's
you.
The thing is being. That's all it requires is the ability to be open. And if you think about how much garbage we're fed, it's garbage that closes us off. Every bit of garbage technology that we've been fed in our lifetimes is technology to close us off from our neighbors. You know, since the advent of the internet, which I love. I love the internet. I think it's great. I think it's a great tool. It's a great resource. We're having a great time on it. We use it for our show. Cell phones, same thing. But since the advent of those things, we don't even know our neighbors' names at this point. We can find out information at the stroke of a key that used to require actual communication with actual human beings. Now, go back even further than when we didn't live in these squared-off Roman-style fucking neighborhoods that blocked us off from the rest of the world and live on concrete, which is very important to me to talk about, that we live on concrete and steel because that separates us from our natural earth. Now, think about how much communication existed with other living beings before we were inundated with all of this garbage. That right there, to me, is such an important thing to think about. The levels of communication, all of the mystics, all of the great religious documents, I mean, the conversations with God, and if you read any religious text, it talks about many, many citations of talking to animals, talking to plants, and I don't think that those were necessarily metaphors. I think that what we're dealing with is the true separation from ourselves. From our divinity, and I think that since we've begun this separation, and we understand the separation, we truly start to see ourselves as some sort of a god because we have to view ourselves as a god because we've lost touch with our own divinity. So it becomes this false sense where we have to replicate it, and we replicate it through things, and not through a true discourse and a true commune with the planet. I mean, and these indigenous tribes, I'm not saying they were more advanced than us in a lot of ways, but I am saying that they did have more communication. They built entire crop cycles around the stars. And now we can't even see the stars from the cities that we live in.
Yeah, no shit. No shit. Hey, I wanted to, this whole idea of, you know, communities living side by side and being very different and interacting, the kind of whole live and let live thing, that's one of my core principles. Along those lines, I want to play a clip for everybody. It's kind of serious. It's about gay marriage. So let's go ahead and give it a listen.
I never understood people judging people for the way they have sex. And some people get angry at homosexuals just for being gay. They get mad at them. Arr! I never really understood that, you know, because they're just having sex with each other. Like, I can understand if gay people were just running out in the streets, just fucking people in the ass willy-nilly, just like a pestilence, like, without asking, you know? Like you're at the ATM. Hey, what the fuck? Jesus! God damn it! Some faggot just fucked me right in the ass. Seriously. Fucking right through my pants. He fucking ruined my new pants. Fucking bullshit. Another one! God damn it, I gotta get the fuck home. This is ridiculous. But they generally don't do that, so I don't know what the fucking problem is. People get mad. They don't want to get married. Well, you don't have to go to the wedding. What the fuck? You don't have to buy him anything? It doesn't matter. So some people go like, well, then a guy will marry his dog. Good. Fucking, I hope he blows his dog. Who gives a shit? It doesn't matter. It doesn't have any effect on your life. What the fuck do you care? Or people that try to think, talk like it's a social issue. Like when you see someone stand up on in a talk show and say like, how am I supposed to explain to my child that two men are getting married? I don't know. It's your shitty kid. You fucking tell him. Why is that anyone else's problem? Two guys are in love, but they can't get married because you don't want to talk to your ugly child for fucking 5 minutes? Who fucking cares about your shitty kid? He's probably a faggot anyway. How stupid is that? All right. Stupid. I don't know. The only thing that bums me out though is that you're not supposed to laugh at gay people when they're funny, because sometimes they just are. They're funny. Like, I lived in New York for a lot of my life, and in my neighborhood everybody was gay. And it, you know, some guys are just a guy walking down the street, but some gay guys are a guy in little shorts and a half shirt and, you know, combat boots spray painted green and a whistle, and he's standing on the corner going, "Hello, it's fucking hot outside." That's not a stereotype. Those guys fucking exist by the thousands. And when I see them, I laugh really loud. I just do. And people are like, "Don't laugh at him because he's gay." No, I'm not. I'm laughing because he's fucking weird and silly. He's hilarious. How am I supposed to react? Hello?
Oh, hello. Hello, yes. Seriousness. Yes.
It's stupid.
That was Louis C.K.
Oh man, funny shit.
You know what the funniest thing is like there's a guy, there's this cat that, you know, people will surprise me with, you know, people that I just really, it's like when I was in Arizona and the amount of like lesbian women I met who hated Mexicans, you know, like that just kind of like surprised me. And there's this other guy, this cat that I worked with who's just like just kind of this hippie dude, you know, he always seemed cool, but he actually apparently he wants to ask the question, what's keep a guy from marrying his dog? Like, people don't worry about that shit. This isn't just a comedian exaggerating, people. People ask these kind of ridiculous questions. They apparently, why do you care?
So before the loss of my internet, we used to log on and watch the show Glee. Have you ever seen this show?
No, I've watched Glee, bro. My ringtone is the Beyonce song from when the fucking football players all dance and shit.
Nice, nice. Yeah, it's a brilliant show, and the gym teacher lady, she also has a segment on the local news station, and one of her little segments was her supporting proposition. It was like Proposition 15 in some small town in Ohio where they're at for legalizing the marriage to marry your pets. And she was like, I mean, it's a pretty cliche joke, but I thought it was funny. She was like, you know, look, people, I'm not advocating the intimacy with your pets. I mean, since when is marriage about intimacy anyway? I don't think it should be have any part in any marriage. I thought it was pretty. So she's talking about this stuff. She's like, she doesn't mention it's about pets, and then the whole thing ends with, you know, the whole intimacy thing it ends with, so should you be able to marry your pets? Absolutely. It's absolutely hilarious.
That show's fucking funny.
But, you know, hey, that show's obviously part of the homosexual conspiracy of Hollywood that Alan Moore talks
about.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Different from what he was talking. It's so funny, the different social things that you hear about, like, you know, in these movements. You know, the Jewish banker conspiracy is one that we're all pretty familiar with at this point. But, you know, some of the other things he mentioned, I was like, yeah, I should really look into that. That sounds frightening.
No, dude, today I was looking for, I would love to at some point, especially if any listeners want to email us, I would really love to have some anti-immigration, or I mean some pro-immigration, people, specialists, whatnot, writers on the show, because it's a really, really big issue for me. That aside, I was online today and I was looking up some stuff about him, just looking up general things about immigration. You know, basically Googled, you know, pro immigration, and I just started looking at things. And I found this website, and I'll have to send you the link, Rabble Rouser, because at first I thought it was for a pro immigration like action website, but in actuality, what it was is it was the conspiracy theory over what pro immigrationists are trying to accomplish, which is apparently an invasion by Mexicans. Apparently that's the conspiracy theory, is that they're literally going to kind of, through illegal immigration, they're going to retake the Southwestern America, which is fucked up.
At least they acknowledge when they say retake it that it was once their fucking land.
Oh, dude, that shit is great. That's great. So apparently people are pissed because a bunch of extra swine flu shots got sent to Wall Street. Like, they're like, we're totally out. We don't have any more. Yes, we had some for Wall Street, especially above and beyond poor. But by the way, folks, more people have died this year from the regular flu than they have from swine flu. Just
so
everybody
knows. Yeah, it's all bullshit, man. It's all bullshit. Healthy food. If you eat healthy local food, which is really easy and not expensive, like people want to think that local food is really expensive, but I mean, nearly every major city has an organics program, a CSA program, community supported agriculture, that is cheaper than going to the grocery store, and you get fresh local vegetables that are microbiotic, and they're indigenous to your bioregion, which means that they flow with the same biological patterns that the earth base that you live in is, which would then put you in touch with the bioregion and the biological patterns of the land base that you live on, and as opposed to eating Peruvian tomatoes and Chilean bananas. Come on.
That should make a huge difference.
I'm not Peruvian, I'm not Chilean, so I'm sorry.
I mean, you figure, fruit that grows in typically, a tropical area has a certain kind of digestive system that's evolved to digest it, and if you're not in tune with that, for the most part, you'll be fine, but, it sends weird messages to your body. And there's a pretty cool farmers organization here in Portland, and it's something like you pay, you can pay, it's cheap. It's like a monthly thing or every few months, but they just deliver.
Are you talking about organics to you?
Yeah, they deliver like crates of veggies to you, and it's just like different shit every week or whatever, or once a month, however often you get it. But it's like when I was shown the numbers, I was like, wow, that's far cheaper than
It was $22 a week when we lived here before and we were doing it. And I think the price has gone up a staggering $6 to $28 a week.
Yeah,
in 6 years, the inflation has brought it up only $6.
I mean, I know that one trip to Whole Foods, we have a Whole Foods in our neighborhood, right near our house.
North Texas has a Whole Foods now?
Yeah, oh no, dude. Right in Northeast, man. It was it started out as Nature's, and this is one of the most interesting things in terms of talking about businesses and workers and stuff. When it was Nature's, part of why I loved going there was because the people who worked there were so fucking happy. I mean, a friend of mine gets a job there, and he went to an employee meeting, and he won a free massage. He was like, oh, my God, this job's great. They're so nice. Everybody's so nice. It's like a big cooperative group of very happy people who are really helpful and kind and all the knowledgeable. And then the company changed to Wild Oats. And it was like – And same friend, he goes to a work meeting, and they had a drawing and everything. And this time, someone won a plastic yard flamingo, right? Free massage, pink yard flamingo, right, when they became Wild Oats. And one of the things that I noticed was people weren't smiling anymore at this place, right? They weren't smiling anymore. Now that it's Whole Foods, it's kind of down the middle. People look either really, like their soul has been really just kind of carved out. They're clean, you know what I mean? They're just gray and depressed and faces tight to some people who are happy, and it's a very, very, very fucked thing. Whereas if you go up to the co-op in the neighborhood, smiling faces.
Yeah.
We got Whole Foods, and it's expensive as shit. And I could easily go in there just to buy the basic things. And yeah, it's going to cost me $30 or $40, really easy. So $30 a week for fresh produce delivered to your house. It's different stuff, and that's local. I mean, that ain't shit, man.
Yeah, we spent $120 last week, 4 days ago, at Fred Meyer, and there's really nothing to account for in our kitchen at all right now. Five meals, and it's gone.
Yeah.
And then our friend Mara comes over last night. Big ups to my girl who is really throwing down hard with the urban gardening. And she's been gardening like crazy, working. She's now got a job working as a gardener for the city, and she gets to garden and give people free food. That's the whole point of it. And she brought over all this amazing stuff that was all from her garden, which is exactly what we did when we lived in St. Louis. We could eat out of our garden on a pretty regular basis and feed a lot of people. I was like, I don't understand why people want to buy this other crap. I don't get it. What makes it more convenient? I don't understand. You're sick.
Okay, so this is an interesting question. Liberty Pyle's still with us in the chat room, and he wrote, all human crops are hybrid forms. For centuries, humans have been genetically selecting preferable traits. The people at the co-op are smiling because they're ripping your ass off and making you feel guilty about shopping elsewhere.
Okay, he is actually correct in a lot of ways. Agrarian societies have been selecting for its choice characteristics certain crops that grow better in certain regions. However, what has happened is because of the monocrop, which has come about because of the growth of population and the sustainability of population. Now, not sustainability with the earth, but that a population rate could be sustainable. What has happened is we've depleted the earth of its ability to create food in the same manner. Monocropping is one of the most damaging forms of agrarian society. So we've had to move on to using all these fertilizers, chemicals, and genetically engineering. Now, what's wrong with genetically engineering is it's not just selecting certain species and certain strains of corn because they grow better in this region. It's actually manipulating the seed to where it will grow anywhere in any way whatsoever. They're actually developing some now. They're developing seeds that can grow without water. This is disgusting. We've come to the point where we understand that we've fucked our water table to the point where we don't have clean water, and so they're starting to grow crops in dry, arid regions without the use of so much water. They're using genetically engineered crops for this. The problem with the genetically engineered crop is it's created mostly of materials. It's not selecting the strains of DNA out of the plant and keeping those and letting the other ones die off. It's introducing different various bacteria and different various strains. And most of the strains, by the way, come from disease. We take disease strains because disease strains of bacteria are resistant for a reason, and they grow better in certain regions for a reason because they are viruses. They are not living plants. They are viruses. And we've created a food that has become viral, that is absolutely not nutritious in any way whatsoever. It's damaging to the land base, and it's viral. That's the problem with GMO crops. So it's not the same process in any way whatsoever as selecting crops because they grow better. It's not the same.
Well, and, you know, also, yeah, I think that they are distinctly different. I mean, especially when it comes to, you know, making something in a lab in Gilligan-Ab, Texas, and then putting that into food everywhere, nothing local happens there, completely detached. And not to mention, I really have to ask the question, like, you know, the genetic code, you can have all sorts of embedded things in there, like what kind of disease gets unlocked by eating funky food like that? And it was like, you know, something that was really intense to me was when we had Joel Salatin on, and he talked about whenever he thinks about all the millions of yards that are out there, millions and millions and millions of yards, you know, like green grass yards, that those are all potential gardens. You know, all of that's there for people to really get hands-on about that and be healthier overall. And, you know, one of my biggest concerns with the genetically modified foods in terms of eating it is we don't know what the fuck it'll do to us. Okay, we have empirical evidence to suggest that over thousands of years, people have eaten certain types of food, and they've been relatively common. But when you start getting into, like, straight-up, like, chemical, molecular manipulation of your food, that becomes a black hole. And, hey, I'm an anarchist. I sign on for uncertainty. I'm not scared of being uncertain of things and how things will go down. I'm totally fine with that. But it's like a fucking abyss of Russian roulette, I think, to really start fucking with things like that. I think that that's really, you know, it's just a really large overstepping of what we need to do in terms of eating food and making food.
Right, and let's look at what the main crops are coming out of certain bioregions now. Let's look at California. What are the main crops coming out of California you can think of?
Oranges.
Yeah, oranges. Okay, oranges is a good one. Number one, the citrus tree is not indigenous to California in a way that it can produce fruits to the level where people can sustain from them. There were occasional patches of citrus trees in mountainous, dry, arid regions that survived because citrus trees can survive under a certain amount of aridity. But, they thrive in a climate more equatorial. That's why they thrive in Central America. They thrive in Florida. and other equatorial regions. They thrive in India and certain parts of India. The citron is huge in the Middle East. I mean, the lemons, that's what's called a citron there. It's huge. But they're not meant to survive in Northern California. They've been modified to do that. Strawberries that are rampant in California have been introduced. The strawberry isn't even an indigenous fruit to California. Blackberries, raspberries, all of these berries are invasive species that have been brought in for the means of production. Now, let's look at what the indigenous fruits and vegetables of California are that are completely non-existent to this day as a use of sustenance. Number one being the acorn. The acorn provided the proteins, the carbohydrates, and all of the grain intake for all of the indigenous peoples of California. They used it for everything. The story in the Bible about manna falling from trees, as many people think that they're talking about acorns, because oak trees did exist in the Middle East at this time because there wasn't a dry, arid desert in biblical times. You make bread out of acorn. Acorn was a tool of sustenance. It was the most plentiful food available, and people lived on it year-round. You could harvest enough acorns that fall on the ground in the fall to survive the entire year-round. Anybody who has a tree that produces acorns in the yard know how many fucking acorns one tree can produce. Now imagine what this landscape was like with those trees everywhere before. Acorns were everywhere. You don't eat acorns anymore. You can get it as a specialty food. I found it at a hunter's shop. I found they had a baked seasoned acorn treats that were like $14 for like 6 ounce bag of acorns. Are you fucking kidding me? This is one of the easiest foods to harvest and to produce. And yet it's not even a part of our diet now. Why is it not a part of our diet? Because it's plentiful and it's free. So they've taken it out of our diet so they could sell us tomatoes that don't even grow this time of year, that they make in hothouses, that they introduce cyanide into the trucks to make them red.
Well, Liberty Pile posted a link to an article I've actually read before, and it was talking about GMOs. And one of the cases it cites is third world nations, their need for food and how these methods can help them have huge crop yields and grow food. But something I want to say is that, you know, again, there wouldn't even be any kind of need or incentive for any of this. If we weren't actively destabilizing areas, okay, we've created massive incentives to make shit that that only appears in the context of civilization, of the state, of the corporate classes. Like, without those things, I just don't see any kind of incentive or desire for our thought process to even go that direction, where we need to try and come up with the massive amounts of food that we can grow that can defy the odds of diseases that naturally occur. And there's no need to even fuck with that if
right.
we're
That's
not
like saying that we need the 3% to be billionaires and multi-billionaires and trillionaires because they give money to the poor.
Right, exactly.
We need the guy to own all of the land. We need Ted Turner to own all of that land. That way, he can donate some of his profits every year that he makes off of all of his other bullshit entities to the poor. Because, you know, so he has to own all that land. If he didn't own all that land, then he couldn't donate that much money to the poor, Travis.
And you know, look.
Does this make sense to you? Why doesn't this make sense to you?
I'm not signing on to the GMO, to the hysteria. I'm not going to sign on to any particular brand of hysteria. You know, what I do question highly is would there even be any incentive to go that way, to do that kind of thing, if we weren't actively destabilizing all these other populations and all these other land bases?
Liberty Pile, I want to ask you, and I know it's going to take you a minute to hear this because of the delay, but let me ask you what your thoughts are on the Somali pirates. So when you hear this question, get back to us in the chat room or call in. We would love to have you call in. Let's talk about what the Somali pirates mean. Because this would be to say that you highly support the Somali pirates and all of their activities, and I'll talk about that when you come in with your response to how you feel about the Somali pirates. And
I've read a lot of articles that talk about the Somali pirates as actually being these kind of a little more in terms of social structure you know, being a lot of the trends of the pirates of the old school days tended to have worker rights and diversity that were more so than
The most egalitarian societies known to its time period were the pirate societies.
Let's see. He says, well, one of his questions, he says, cyanide, ? I don't know what, I didn't catch what he was responding to. He says, it's ethylene and comes from
tomatoes.
He says, it's ethylene and comes from banana peels. This is how you make a unripe green tomato turn red. I do it all the time with my own tomatoes.
Okay. Ask him to Google the introduction of cyanide into tomatoes in shipping trucks. This was a big, big thing that was happening in the mid-90s. They were finding that a lot of the tomatoes that were coming in had unreasonable levels. This is what's funny to me. Unreasonable levels of cyanide were found on hothouse tomatoes in grocery stores and supermarkets in the Midwest that were getting their tomatoes from California, because they were introducing levels of cyanide into the trucks to help the ripening process of the tomatoes. I believe it was Dole that was doing this. I know it was somebody, it's not United Fruit because they don't exist in under that term anymore. I believe it was Dole or Del Monte, maybe Del Monte, they got slapped with a fine for this. Of course, they weren't put out of business and sent to prison for potentially poisoning a large part of the population. But this isn't a conspiracy theory. I remember this being big news in the mid-90s during the tomato scare, when tomatoes were being found with hepatitis C. In Tucson, Arizona, where I lived, there was a moratorium put on all outsourced tomatoes because of the hepatitis C scare that was coming in. And that had to do mainly with the fertilizer that was being used with human waste. That was uncleansed human waste, which is fine to use human waste as a fertilizer as long as it goes through the process that needs to of composting properly. You'll find it. It's there. Has he responded to the Somali pirates question yet?
So, yeah, he has. And he just said, he's like, you know, I don't know much about them. I imagine that it's a way for them to make a lot of money really quickly. Otherwise, they wouldn't do it. I don't see any other incentive for robbing neighboring ships. But honestly, I don't know anything about them or their history. And I'm paraphrasing because I'm in the next room. But essentially, it's just okay. Like I imagine they do it to make a lot of money. I don't know a lot about them.
It's actually not at all why they do it. The reason that the Somali pirates exist is because the Sea of Aden, the sea that they had been fishers in, these are fishermen, number one, have been taken over by the U.S. military and the U.S. trade routes to bring weapons and goods to different various regions of the Middle East, Egypt and just north of Dubai, in the provinces there. This is a huge trade route. And so what's happened is the fishermen aren't allowed to fish their own waters anymore, which is the sustenance for the people of the Sudan. This is how they survive. So the Somali pirates started doing this as a backlash against these trade ships. Their interest is not at all into making money off of these trade ships. Their interest is in actually getting these trade ships to as a disincentive for them to come through that sea, so they can fish their own sea. Every captive that's been held captive by the Somali pirates have told stories of being fed amazing Western meals, which aren't the meals that the Somali pirates were eating. They were feeding these people this because of their power. They were given cigarettes, candy. They were given booze, even though the Somali pirates themselves don't drink. And they were treated like guests as opposed to hostages. They weren't threatened in any way. And beyond the fact that they were taken by gunpoint, which, of course, is a traumatic, threatening experience. But these pirates, their entire reason for existing is to regain the fishing waters that feed their people. That's it. That's all it is. So the Somali pirates exist for the same reason the GMO crops exist. They exist because multinational corporations have taken over the resources of their land and given them nothing to survive on. GMO crops exist for that reason. They exist as a way to allow a small percentage of companies to profit greatly from the force feeding of their products to people who can no longer provide for themselves because of the multinational corporations that have stripped the resources of their land away.
So we've got about 10 seconds left. So any final words? Do you want to say goodnight?
Goodnight.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. Liberty File, thanks for sticking with us for the whole show. We'll see everybody again next week.
I'll see you tomorrow, G20, you bastard.
Shit. I'm going to come see you like a friend.
Aw, like a friend.
Oh, wait. Sorry, we have 60 seconds left, so you can say goodnight for longer.
Good night.
I'm saying goodnight to Liberty Pyle in the chat room. What a guy. He's the only person in the chat room for the whole show. Listening, pondering.
Our biggest fan.
I know, right?
Oh, by the way, I want to send this out to Parker. Parker listens to us every week. I think he's in Belgium. Parker loves the show, and Parker, it's nice that you're listening in, man, and it's good to be back on air, and I'm hoping that you're digging this. Please keep listening in. And to our Radio for All listeners, we're back. We're going to be posting this up, and then soon we'll be broadcasting live from various locations around Portland. So the show is going to change exponentially. It's going to become a really amazing dynamic format now that our forces are going to be combined physically one of these days.
Yeah.
So, yeah, please start tuning in. Tell your friends. The show's about to get powerful because we're going to be doing live guests, live musicians, live audience, and it's going to be good.
Awesome. Thanks for listening, everybody. As always, we'll be back Sundays. This is G20 Sided Dice and Rabble Rouser, kicking ass, taking names, and whatnot. And rolling some dice.
Take a punch, give a hug, and always stand up.
Word. Good night, everybody.
Good night.